I'm Alexis Livingston. This is number 0268, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there! Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0268. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have a return visit with author Dennis Palumbo. He's on talking about his new Daniel Rinaldi mystery novel. This one is called Phantom Limb.
Phantom Limb is the feeling that an amputated body part, like an arm or a leg, is still there, that it itches or that it gets cold. And what I do in the novel, in the midst of all the action, adventure, and twist, is I begin to develop the idea that everybody has a phantom limb. In other words, everybody has a felt sense of a loss, either of a loved one or a spouse, through a divorce or a parent, and that we carry the idea that that person somehow is still around.
Therapist Lori Battito is the author of The Sex Bible for People Over 50.
Our bodies do change, and there's adaptations. Our sexuality is not a constant thing. It's fluid, it's in flux, and as we age, changes happen, but that doesn't mean it's worse, it just means it's different. So I wanted to at least make people aware of these changes that are perfectly normal changes, because people tend to panic when they're no longer the same, when they don't function the same way.
Florence Calderon Blake is the author of The Sicilian Nobleman's Daughter, which tells the story of how her mother repeatedly tried to kill her.
She made the 3 attempts on my life in one day when I was 14 years old. She tried to choke me. I broke the chokehold. She was infuriated. And when I wasn't looking, she grabbed a table knife, pinned me down to the kitchen table, and tried to slit my throat.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And, of course, an idiot of the day, the guest later. The person who told you this was show number 0268 was graphic artist Alexis Livingston. And you can check out her website at alexislivingstonphotography.com. That's alexislivingstonphotography.com. And by the way, there's no E on the end of Livingston, okay? So that's alexislivingstonphotography.com. Thank you very much, Alexis, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? You know, it wasn't such a big deal that 50-year-old Karen Marie Dilworth was having sex with a motorcycle in her Osmond Beach, Florida garage. The problem was the garage door was open, and the young boy outside and various other neighbors couldn't help but to notice. Yeah. Dilworth, who admitted to police that she had been drinking, of course she was arrested and charged with lewd, lascivious exhibition by a person over 18 on a person under 16. She denied having sex with the motorcycle. Then what was she doing in the garage? Smoking, she said. Yeah. Smoking. Is that smoking or smoking afterward? You know, there's a big difference there. I'm just saying. Okay, Keenan Shaw says his offense wasn't that bad. There's kids selling smokes. There was a kid last year selling meth, as well as a kid selling acid. The 12th grader sold Pepsi out of his locker at Winston Churchill High School in Lethbridge, Alberta. And when he wouldn't stop, it led to a 2-day suspension. We can't just have anyone coming into the school selling anything they want in the school, said Lethbridge School's Superintendent Cheryl Gilmore. But Gilmore agrees that a Pepsi doesn't justify a suspension. We would talk to them about why it doesn't follow our, you know, nutritional policy, she said, apparently speaking hypothetically to avoid violating student privacy. What might get a hypothetical student suspended, you ask? Well, persistent or chronic disobedience or disregard of district or school rules. You know, even if he never learns about nutrition, he'd better learn to obey. I think that's what basically the school is saying. And also, I think this says more about the laziness of youth. And I'm not saying that to sound like some kind of old fogey or codger. No, because back in the late 60s when I was going to grade school, I would buy candy that sold for 2 cents, or rather two for a penny, and then sell them at school for 1 cent each, thereby making a hefty profit, just like, by the way, this Pepsi kid did. The store I bought the candy from was less than a block away from school, so basically, I was making some nice money because my classmates were too lazy or slow-thinking to buy candy on their way to school. And where there are lazy people, there are entrepreneurs waiting to reap the benefits, like this kid selling Pepsi out of a locker at school. Don't believe me? Look around. Just count the places that will sell you food at a drive-thru. Case closed. Okay, a September raid on an ISIS safe house in Syria turned up, among other items, according to Foreign Policy magazine, a Dell laptop owned by Tunisian jihadist Muhammad S., containing, not unexpectedly, recipes for bubonic plague and ricin, and, probably less likely, a recipe for banana mousse and a variety of songs by Celine Dion. Okay. Hearing that a terrorist has a banana mousse recipe almost kind of humanizes him. So let's just move on to basically what is definitely the elephant in the room. And that is, you know, I have come across many people who claim they can't stand Celine Dion. But I've never come across anyone who would dare make the analogy that her singing is the equivalent of terrorism. But I fear that now some will make that leap. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our first guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, 13-year-old Avery Gagliano of Washington, D.C., is a world-renowned piano prodigy who has played by invitation in Germany, Hong Kong, Connecticut, and dozens of other places. Yeah, world centers, you know, like Connecticut. That doesn't impress Alice Deal Middle School officials, however. To do such performances, she had to miss more than 10 days of school, Avery did, which makes her a truant. And they don't just say that. They have accused her of truancy in writing, and their letters threatened her parents with legal action, even though her parents kept Avery on a rigorous independent study school curriculum. DCPS is unable to excuse Avery's absence due to her piano travels, performances, rehearsals, etc., wrote Jemia Gosso, an attendance specialist with DC Public Schools Office of Youth Engagement. Wow, that is one highfalutin, obnoxious business card, isn't it? Attendance specialist? The Office of Youth Engagement? Anyway, the girl's parents say they were bombarded by automated phone calls and letters. And after more than a year of simply trying to convince school officials, her parents gave up. We decided to homeschool her because of all the issues, her father said. Avery had been in public school since kindergarten. She's a great success story for the schools. The Washington Post picked up on Avery's story. And when that happened, D.C.'s public school chancellor said the article was inaccurate and misleading, despite the pile of written proof. She blamed the parents for not explaining things well enough, even though they tried, like I said earlier, for over a year. As we continue to work to make improvements in enforcing truancy protocols, Chancellor Kaya Henderson said, the lesson here is the need for better and more timely communication. Yeah, well, the good news here is the head school chief understands there's a lesson to be learned. The bad news is she doesn't understand who needs to learn it in this case. Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? Yes. Anybody who listens to this show regularly knows that Dennis Palumbo is one of my favorite authors. In addition to being a writer, he is also a licensed psychotherapist and a former Hollywood screenwriter. His fourth crime novel in the Daniel Rinaldi series is called Phantom Limb, and it has just been released. And Dennis joins us on the line right now from California. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks once again for being on the program with us.
Well, it's always a pleasure talking to you.
So Daniel Rinaldi is at it again. And
yes.
What is this particular story, this particular book about Phantom Limb?
Well, Phantom Limb has a plot that has two different threads in it. In the first one, a new patient of Daniel's is kidnapped right outside his office, and he ends up being involved with the police in trying to rescue her and bring the kidnappers to justice. At the same time, for longtime readers of my series, they know that his best friend is a paranoid schizophrenic named Noah Fry. Noah has a girlfriend whose brother has just returned Afghan campaign and has lost a leg to an IED, and he has a prosthetic. Unfortunately, he's suffering the symptoms of phantom limb. For those who don't know, phantom limb is the feeling that an amputated body part, like an arm or a leg, is still there, you know, that it itches or that it gets cold. And what I do in the novel, in the midst of all the action, adventure, and twists, is I begin to develop the idea that everybody has a phantom limb. In other words, everybody has a felt sense of a loss, either of a loved one or a spouse, you know, through a divorce or a parent, and that we carry the idea that that person somehow is still around. You know, we can feel their presence in our life. And so because Daniel's wife was murdered and his father, the beat cop, has long since died of alcoholism, he talks about having a felt sense that they're both still around. And so I use phantom limb not only in the story structure and as a narrative device, but also as a metaphor for how all of us deal with loss. And I try to weave that kind of characterological thinking in a very fast-paced, suspenseful novel.
Now, when I first read the synopsis of this latest Daniel Rinaldi mystery, just as you described it, there's more than one thing going on here in this book. You've literally got two major plot points going on, converging at the same time. And I'm just wondering, as you write these mysteries, now that you're fourth one, do you feel you have to keep, like, upping the ante with each one you do?
Well, a little bit, to be honest with you. It's not like, you know, okay, now we have to have Cleveland blow up. But it's more a sense of I want the writing to deepen, the stakes to get higher, and the mystery to get more puzzling. And particularly weaving two plots together, which, believe it or not, they actually connect. But in no way does it look like that initially to the reader. You'd have no idea that these stories are going to connect, and they are. And that is really a thrill to write. It's also really difficult to pull off.
I mentioned, again, the three previous books, A Mirror Image, Fever Dream, Night Terrors, and now this one, which is called Phantom Limb. You just mentioned that as a writer, you're always trying to top yourself and improve as a writer. Just so happens that earlier this summer, I read one of your earlier novels, City Wars. And I
Yes, my first novel, which was written way back in the late 70s, a science fiction novel that Bantam Books published that is now available as an ebook. Yeah.
And I really enjoyed it. And I wanted to bring it up just now because, again, it's sort of like with my last question, with this Daniel Rinaldi series and also with stuff you've written from way back when, how do you feel you've changed as a writer?
I think, to be honest with you, my understanding of human behavior. I think that City Wars is a pretty good book and pretty exciting. But as I've, you know, so I'm almost three decades now as a licensed psychotherapist. And I think that understanding of human behavior, the experience of so many people struggling with so many issues, has allowed my writing to deepen. So that, you know, when people review my Rinaldi novels, they don't just talk about the plot or the suspense, they all talk about the characterizations. And that's important to me. I think it helps make my writing more vivid for people, and certainly more relatable at the human level.
The character of Daniel Rinaldi as a therapist works closely with the police department, but even though he works closely with the police department, he doesn't always have the best rapport with some people within it. Does he continue to butt heads in this one?
Oh, yeah. Well, you have to remember that, you know, he's a civilian. He's not a policeman, so they don't like that. And he's a psychologist, and most cops, you know, are extremely suspicious of psychology in general. The last thing they want is to have their head shrunk. And so he's kind of a thorn in their side. And I actually like that. I like the adversarial relationship he has with people with whom he's supposed to be consulting. I think it gives a lot of energy to the book, and it's also one of the big sources of humor is his interaction with the police.
I know
he's kind of a smartass sometimes.
I know I've asked you this question on previous occasions when you've been on the program, but now that you've written this fourth book, are you still yourself, as you write the Daniel Rinaldi series, still learning about the character?
Oh, absolutely. I learned, in fact, if people who've read the earlier books, Phantom Limb delivers a big shock at the end that asks us to rethink aspects of Daniel Rinaldi's past. And so he's growing as a character. He's maturing, I think. And once in a while, he surprises even me.
There's a certain darkness within Daniel's personality. How would you deal with Daniel if he were your patient?
Oh, I think he has anger management issues. There's no question about that. I think he's a wounded narcissist. I think he certainly suffers from a loss of maternal love. His mother died when he was 3, and he had an alcoholic father who was physically abusive of him. So he walks around, despite his enormous empathy for people and compassion for the underdog, he does have kind of a chip on his shoulder. And I would work on that with him a little bit.
It's almost like the old saying, you know, the cobbler's children go without shoes. Here we have the therapist who is pretty much broken.
Yeah, he is kind of broken. But what matters is he can still have a mission, which is to help victims. Maybe he won't at the end be able to help himself, but he'll be able to help others. And that's kind of the way I looked at him.
As time progresses, does it become easier or more difficult for you to write as these novels, the Daniel Rinaldi series?
I think it becomes harder only in the sense I keep wanting each book to be better than the one before. I think I'm less anxious about the characters. I know the characters pretty well now, not only Daniel, but all of the supporting characters. But what is harder is to make sure the stories stay fresh, that they're intriguing, that they're suspenseful, and that the twists are unique. You know, there's a lot of suspense thrillers out there, and you want to, you know, stand above the herd if you can. And I try my very best to make it a unique read for people.
Are we getting any closer to seeing this transferred to either the small or big screen?
There's lots of interest. But, you know, in Hollywood, you know, that and $4 will get you a Starbucks. So, but there is a lot of people, there are a lot of people sniffing around this, particularly as a TV series. So I'll keep you posted.
We'd love to hear that. And I'm looking forward to reading this one, Phantom Limb. As I said, I've read the previous three, and to be honest, can't really stop gushing about them. They're fun reads. Dennis, I thank you very, very much for being on the program once again. It's always a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, it's always a pleasure talking to you, Peter, and thanks so much.
Dennis Palumbo, author of Phantom Limb. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0268, and you'll find links to Dennis's site, plus links to Amazon.com, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show. Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if, for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk about sex over 50, and that's an age, by the way, not an accumulation. I just want to get that straight right now. Also, the author of The Sicilian Nobleman's Daughter will be on the program. Plus, of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day, and of course, lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, a New Zealand woman said she awoke recently to discover her home and car had been covered in what she believes to be human feces from an airplane. Karen Bass of Auckland said she awoke Sunday to discover that there were splotches of brown matter all over her house and her silver car. Bass said her home is directly in the flight path of planes coming into Auckland International Airport. The first thing when I walked out of my door this morning and I saw it, I thought an airplane bleeped on us. You can pretty well guess what that bleep was, right? You open the door and it smells like excrement. That's what she told the New Zealand Herald. And no, she didn't actually use the word excrement. I just used the word excrement. I'm absolutely disgusted at the moment. The amount of crap everywhere is horrendous. She did use the word crap, by the way. That was her word. Bass said she is going to have a sample of the feces independently tested to verify it came from humans. There's no way it's a bird or animal poo. It's horrible. I'm sure it's human. What else could it be with huge clumps like that, she said. An Airways New Zealand spokeswoman suggested Bass complain directly to the offending airline, but the homeowner said she could not know which airline to address as she didn't see the plane. Well, you know, I guess if she wants to investigate a little further, she could start by finding out which airlines serve high-fiber diets on their jets. That's my guess for some help there. Speaking of diets, by the way, a British cafe is testing the limits of good taste in the morning with the Hibernator. It's a breakfast dish packed with a whopping 8,000 calories. Mark Winder, who is the owner of the Bear Grylls Cafe in England, said that only 20 customers so far have attempted to take on the Hibernator, which weighs 7 pounds and amounts to nearly 4 times the daily recommended caloric intake for an adult man. Winder said no one has yet succeeded to finish the dish, which he requires diners to sign waivers before attacking. It's called the Hibernator because if anyone completes it, they'll have to sleep for a year, Winder said. The breakfast includes 4 fried eggs, 4 strips of bacon, 8 sausages, 4 hash browns, a 4-egg cheese omelet, 4 waffles, 4 pieces of toast, 4 pieces of fried bread, 4 pieces of black pudding, 2 ladles of beans, tomatoes, mushrooms, French fries, and a 2,000-calorie milkshake to wash it all down. Oh, please, tell me this thing comes with a rib spreader. Ugh. I'm having a coronary just thinking about this, but what's also startling is everybody knows that the term British cuisine is an oxymoron, right? I mean, seriously. Moving right along, Halloween horror came early for some amusement park goers in England when a roller coaster hit a deer and covered the passengers in blood, a spokeswoman for the Lightwater Valley theme park near Ripon, England, confirmed the deer wandered onto a track for the Ultimate, that's billed as Europe's longest roller coaster, and was struck by one of the roller coaster cars. "We can confirm a young deer did unfortunately get hit by the Ultimate train yesterday and was killed instantly," the spokeswoman said. "There is a large perimeter fence around the theme park, but occasionally wild animals do manage to stray onto the park during the night. The roller coaster was closed for 30 minutes before resuming normal operations." Wow, only 30 minutes? Wow! Doesn't it take longer than that to hose everything down? 30 minutes? Anyway, reports indicate passengers were sprayed with the animal's blood, but there were no human injuries from the crash. A deer previously wandered onto the Ultimate's tracks back in 1994 and was struck by a car, resulting in the hospitalization back then of a 12-year-old boy. So it's not like this is unprecedented. Perhaps more thought should go into making it difficult for deer to get into this theme park. And by the way, do the concession stands at the theme park sell venison? Just checking. And finally, in this section of Stuff File News, before we get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, the job of determining stress levels in whales is itself apparently very stressful. The most reliable information about tension lies in hormones, most accurately measured by researchers boarding a boat, sidling up to a whale, and waiting until it blasts snot out of its blowhole. By catching enough of it, or wiping it off their raincoats, I would assume, scientists can run the gunk through chemical tests. However, a team of engineering researchers at Olin College in Needham, Massachusetts, told the Boston Globe in September that they were on the verge of creating a radio-controlled mucus-trapping drone that would bring greater civility to the researchers' job and reduce the add-on stress that whales must feel at being stalked by motorboats. Okay. So, I just have a question here that I'm going to pose only to the ladies in the audience. So, ladies, listen up for just a moment, please, okay? So, you meet some guy in a bar, and you ask him what he does, and he says, "I'm a biologist." And you say, "Oh, how lovely. What does that entail?" And he says, "I go out to sea and capture whale snot to study their stress levels." So, here's my question to you, ladies. Do you stick around with a follow-up question, or do you move on to the accountant-looking guy drinking by himself in the corner? That's what I want to know. Ponder that. Get back to me on that one, okay? You can send me an email to peter@thestufffile.com if you have an answer. Let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? Dr. Lori Batito is a clinical psychologist, host of the popular sex and relationship show Passion on CJD here in Montreal, and she's also the author of a new book called The Sex Bible for People Over 50, The Complete Guide to Sexual Love for Mature Couples. Lori joins us on the line right now from here in Montreal. Hi, Lori.
Hey, how are you?
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us.
Thank you.
So a guide to sex at 50 and beyond, you know, the biggest part of the population has always been, for the longest time, baby boomers. So it doesn't surprise me that a book like that would come out. But is it really different than under 50?
Of course. First of all, lots of changes happen. You and I both now, Peter, being over 50, that we're not the same as when we were 20. Even if our minds stay the same, more or less, our bodies do change. And there's adaptations. So our sexuality is not a constant thing. It is always, it's fluid, it's in flux. And as we age, changes happen. But that doesn't mean it's worse. It just means it's different. So I wanted to at least make people aware of these changes that are perfectly normal changes, because people tend to panic when they're no longer the same, when they don't function the same way. I get men panicking because their erections aren't as hard as they once were. They don't know what's wrong with them. And, you know, women who suddenly have pain with intercourse and they don't know what's wrong with them, and they're not sure. Is it age? Is it menopause? So I wanted to just clarify, you know, and look at all the potential issues that can happen with age and how to adapt to that so we can have the best sex of our lives.
You've been doing the radio show for about 15 years now. Is this is this book an outgrowth of some of the questions that have come up in the show, or is it totally unrelated?
No, it's completely an outgrowth, not only of my listenership and the questions, which if we look at the statistics in terms of my listenership, my average listener is somewhere in the 45 to 55, you know, age range. So most of those listeners fall within that category. So they have questions. Many questions about sexual functioning later, but I've also been a clinician for the last 24 years. So in my practice, I also see that. So that, you know, these are the questions that come up. And again, people feel like there's, you know, they're abnormal for some reason. And that's what I wanted to dispel, really look at some of the myths.
As you say, the change is natural, but generally speaking, as a society, are we too tied into our sexuality being our being? In other words, it's a part of who we are, but it's not all of who we are.
Right. And it should not be all of who we are, because if we put everything into our genitals and our genitals malfunction, then who are we? We don't want that. So this book explores sexuality in a much wider, like a much wider scope of sexuality. Sexuality is not just about penis and vagina. And often this is what we hear when we think of the word sex. That's what people think about. And that's what I wanted to get away from, because sexuality can mean many, many different things. The problem is that when there's a problem with sex, it takes up a lot of space in a relationship. When everything is working fine, then it's not as important. So I wanted to get to a point where we can avoid having these problems. And it opens up the communication, too, by couples reading this book together.
Speaking of couples, generally speaking, who do you find is more apt to be open about discussing this, men or women?
It's not just that who's apt to be discussing it. Men tend to bring up the subject more often, probably because men are the ones who might have the higher sex drive than women. At least that's how it's expressed. For the most part, I'm generalizing here, but the ones who seek answers are often women. They're the ones buying all the self-help books, right? The men aren't pulling those off the shelf. The women are. So I wanted a book that actually men would find appealing to, which is why I put pictures in it, naked pictures.
Gotcha.
I know that sounds rather sexist in reverse, but I thought I was polling all my guy friends and they felt that that would be an incentive.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that sex does change with age. So do you have a few ideas, you know, generally speaking, how to adapt to that change?
Well, part of it depends what you're adapting to, right? So as we age, we could have different difficulties, like some people develop arthritis or some people develop other kind of chronic ailments or pain and what have you, things that are unrelated to our sexual functioning, but that impact sex. So I have chapters on positions, for example, how to adapt to different positions using the old way, but adapting in a new way to relieve the pressure off bad knees, bad back, etc. That's one thing. The other thing is how to take care of your genitals as they age. So a big chapter on female sexual health and female changes. So for, you know, making sure that women keep their vaginas in good working order, but that requires, you know, some maintenance, if you will, some oiling to some degree, and men too. So when men happen to have the occasional erectile dysfunction, you know, when does it require medication, or when does it require intervention, and when does it not require intervention? So it's kind of knowing the difference and how to adapt to that.
Is it also a sign that if you're having problems sexually, and I'm looking at this now from the male point of view, that sometimes
right.
that's a sign of other problems besides, in other words, the lack of sexual activity, or not activity, but proficiency can be a sign of another problem within the body?
I think that's a great point. Yes, it can be a sign of another problem within the body. So, for example, erectile dysfunction in men, the first thing I have them do is have a blood workup done to make sure that, you know, they don't have anything else going on in their blood work. Also, we look for blood flow. So if the blood isn't flowing to the penis, it usually means it's not flowing elsewhere. So we want to look at that. So you check blood pressure, you check other things. So that's really, really important to look at, you know. But I'm also looking at it another way. Sometimes couples that have sexual problems, the sexual problems are a symptom of the relationship, of something else. So that's another way of also looking at it. But in the way that I wrote this book for couples who don't have other difficulties, like where the only real issues come affecting sexuality.
Besides the physical, with age, what about the mental part? Does one's desire diminish, or is that a myth?
The desire, it is a myth, because it's not true that desire completely, that it diminishes. There's a difference between desire and interest, okay? Sometimes we confound the two. So when we talk about desire, we talk about someone's level of horniness, if you will, right? The spontaneous desire for sexual activity. That may diminish, and for women especially, about 3/4 of women will describe that, but their interest in sex isn't affected. So they would still want to, they just need the conditions to be right. So their motivation for sex, that's really what we're looking at, is one's motivation. So instead of desire, we look at the motivation.
A lot can be learned by people who read the Sex Bible for people over 50 who are in that age group. Can a lot be learned by somebody reading this who is younger?
Well, I had this one, I was giving a talk at a CJEP. He says, I'm buying your book. I want to be prepared. You've got a ways to go to be prepared. But so anybody who wants to expand their sexual repertoire, this book is useful for, because there are chapters on how to stretch your boundaries as well. So, and, you know, knowledge is power. So getting this book prior to turning 50 so that you're aware of some of the potential changes that will occur later on will better prepare you for your later life sexuality.
Plus, as you say, you give tips on ideas of positions and other things. So variety is the spice of life, right? It doesn't have to be just for those over 50.
That's right. Exactly.
Lori, I thank you very, very much for being on the program to talk with us. It's great to have a chance to talk with you about your new book. Congratulations.
Well, thanks for having me. I miss talking to you on the air, so this is great.
Dr. Lori Batito, author of The Sex Bible for People Over 50, The Complete Guide to Sexual Love for Mature Couples. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0268, and you'll find the links to Lori's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. Here's an unusual story out of California. A newspaper there recently revealed that a San Diego woman has filed 243 lawsuits against businesses there for violating the Americans with Disabilities Act. That's a large number of lawsuits for one person, but it isn't what makes this story unusual. The surprising part is that she's suing her own lawyer who filed the lawsuits. Her lawyer had claimed that some of the businesses he sued on her behalf failed to accommodate her blindness and wheelchair needs. The problem with that, she says, is that she sees well enough to drive and has never even used a wheelchair. Let's be fair. Stories like this help explain why nearly half of all ADA lawsuits in America are filed in California. The law there allows people to sue even if they haven't been harmed by minor violations of the law, and that has prompted widespread abuse. These lawsuits don't help the disabled, and they've hurt thousands of honest job providers. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
If you or someone you care about is struggling with food and body image issues, don't ignore the signs. Eating disorders are serious, potentially life-threatening illnesses, but recovery is possible, and you don't have to suffer alone. Call the National Eating Disorders Association helpline at 800-931-2237 or visit nationaleatingdisorders.org to take a confidential online eating disorder screening. Recovery is possible.
From Montreal, Canada, and spanning the globe like a butterfly on speed, this is The Stuff File with Peter Anthony Holden.
And still to come in the program, we'll talk to the author of The Sicilian Nobleman's Daughter. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And lots more Stuff File news right here, right now, on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, The Smarter Way to listen to radio. Have I mentioned Stitcher Smart Radio before? I think I've mentioned it once or twice. A visitor to a state park in Humboldt County, California, ran across a state park ranger on duty, but asleep in his patrol car. The visitor tried to wake him up, but couldn't. Perhaps the open can of Keystone Light beer between the ranger's legs was part of the problem here. The visitor snapped a photo and called 911, but by the time the nearest law enforcement officer could check things out, the ranger had awakened and driven away. But the California Highway Patrol caught up with the ranger and pulled him over. Tyson Young, a 10-plus year veteran ranger, was arrested on suspicion of drunk driving and turned over to his supervisor, who suspended him pending a full investigation. You know, these are not the kind of things you ever heard the ranger doing in the Yogi Bear cartoons. Oh, sure, maybe the occasional picnic basket, but that's about it. Habitual petty criminal, 47-year-old Todd Bontrager, charged with trespassing for probing various locked doors at a church in Broward County, Florida, in August, admitted skirting the law a few times in his life, but he said it was only to, quote, study. He wanted to study. He said incarceration improves your concentration abilities. That's what he told a very skeptical judge, John J. Hurley, who promptly ordered him to jail to, so said the judge, and I like this, further concentrate. Apparently Todd has a lot to learn. And we have another winner in a similar vein. 24-year-old American Matthew Miller told the Associated Press that he had a wild ambition when he entered North Korea in April, that he wanted to experience prison life there in order to secretly investigate the country's human rights stance. In September, he was convicted of espionage in a 90-minute trial and will be conducting his investigation amidst hard labor over a 6-year period beginning immediately. Well, I bet his parents must be proud. Must be proud. And we have one more item to get to before we get to our last guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Actually, it's a couple of stories about less than competent criminals. Story number one, a 35-year-old guy named Roma Sims of Westerville, Ohio, was sentenced to just over 8 years in prison in August for stealing the identities of more than 500 people between 2009 and 2013, before he was done in by having misspelled the names of several cities in various documents while working said scheme. For example, the largest city in Kentucky is Louisville, and Louisville is not spelled L-O-U-I-E-V-I-L-L-E, in case you didn't know that. Oops. And least competent criminal number two, in Sebastopol, California, 20-year-old Dylan Stables, already on probation, was arrested again mid-morning on July 22nd when, with stolen credit cards in his possession, he decided to drive his car even with transmission problems. Police noticed him as he slowly drove through town in reverse gear. Yeah, because anybody who's ever had transmission problems, and I've been there, when your transmission goes, reverse is the only gear that works. But usually that's a hint to stop, not keep driving. I mean, wow. You know, both of these guys came dangerously close to becoming the idiots of the day, but I stopped short on both cases because we do have an idiot of the day coming up a little later on. And I'll share that with you in a few moments. But first, let's get to our last guest on this edition of the Stuff File program, shall we? Florence Calderon Blake has had a harrowing life, a very violent childhood. Her own parents tried to kill her on several occasions. Her father killed his own sister and tried to kill all five of his children. But Florence is here to tell the tale, and she has even written about it. Her autobiography is entitled The Sicilian Nobleman's Daughter, and Florence joins us on the line from Oregon. Hi, Florence.
Hello.
Thanks for being on the program with us. I want to start off with the fact that you've been through such a harrowing story. It's a story that anybody who's been through it would want to write, but what made you decide to finally share your story?
Because it glorified God, because it says you don't have to turn to a life of crime or drugs or child abuser or really be a renegade just because things happened to you. You can glorify God and let people know that God is on your side, that he's there to rescue you, and that he's your true friend. You don't need anybody else on earth. You have God, and he's the real true friend, and I wanted that known.
I mentioned that your mother tried to kill you. She tried to kill you several times, and she even tried to do it before you were born, correct?
She tried to abort me before I was born. Abortion was not legal at the time, but she tried anyway. And even then, God intervened and rescued me.
And then what happened after you were born? How did she try to hurt you then?
Well, my siblings had whooping cough when I was being born in the hospital. My mother should not have taken me home to that situation. Those kids should have been quarantined, and I should have been protected from it. But she brought me home. I caught whooping cough. I almost died. And a neighbor alerted the Board of Health, and they put me in the hospital, and they saved my life. And she said that meddling neighbor should have stayed out of it. He should have let her die. That was one thing. She made the 3 attempts on my life in one day when I was 14 years old. She tried to choke me. I was a slum kid. In the slums, we learned how to fight. We learned how to break a chokehold, okay? I broke the chokehold. She was infuriated, and she, when I wasn't looking, she grabbed a table knife, pinned me down to the kitchen table, and tried to slit my throat with a 6-inch blade. And she was doing it. She was in the process. It was working. She was actually cutting my throat. And God sent a miraculous rescue. I mean, really out of the blue.
What?
It was unprecedented.
What was
he's
it?
He's perfect. He knows what he's doing. Then she tried to starve me to death.
Well, what was it? What was it, Florence, that your mother had against you? Why was it she was literally hell-bent on trying to kill you?
I was the target child. I was the only one of her kids that looked like my father's family. She despised my father's family. She was more or less forced into marrying him because of Sicilian customs and because she was a penniless orphan when my father was the only one that proposed. So the relatives that were raising her just wanted to get rid of her, so they married her off into this family. And she hated me because I looked so much like him. And she said that I had the same traits as he did. Well, he really had a pretty rotten family. I mean, that's all explained in the story. They were murderous people, and she just couldn't stand them. She couldn't stand me. There's a lot of complications we don't have time to go into, but in short, my older brothers would always blame me for everything they did wrong, and my mother would believe them. She would believe that I broke the lamp in the living room if they said that I had broken it, and she beat me until I admitted that I had done it and then decided I was a terrible liar because at first I denied doing it because I hadn't done it. You know what I mean? This was the story of my childhood. I was constantly being accused, and my brothers would swear to it. My mother would believe them. She would not believe me. So she really labeled me a horrible, troublemaking brat that couldn't tell her the truth and all that sort of junk.
Okay, so it was... So
God
it was,
a... was on my side, and he showed me when he rescued me from her knife that he was on my side. When she tried to starve me to death, she deprived food from me and money or any means of getting food. It was up to 3 days, and she was going to do it until I died. I mean, she said, I'm going to starve you to death. You will not have access to food or a way to get food or money to get food. And on the third day of the fast, I woke up trembling from hunger. I knew the Lord's Prayer. And when I got to the part that says, give us this day our daily bread, I stopped and I said, now, wait a minute, God, I haven't eaten in 3 days. What do you mean daily bread? And the Holy Spirit, you know, that still small voice in 1 Kings 19:12, that still small voice informed me how I could get food. And it worked. And I was able to eat legally without committing any crimes. I was able to get food.
Florence, let me ask you this. It was a different time period, obviously. You don't have the type of services that are available for kids today. But as you said, you were a very tough child growing up in a rough neighborhood. Did the possibility of running away ever cross your mind at that time?
Absolutely not, because the streets were not anywhere near safer. They were highly dangerous. We did not walk to school. We sprinted to school. We had to get away from the gangs. These gangs had literally beaten kids to death on the street. And it was horribly unsafe. So I knew that I wouldn't make it. I was 14, but I looked about 12 and never be able to get a job. I'd never be able to survive on the streets. So for all that it was at home, it was still safer than out there. And frankly, Peter Anthony, if somebody is so accustomed to something like that all the time, every day, they think it's normal. You don't think at a time like that, well, there's something wrong with my family. They're not normal people. If I ran away or got into a foster home, I'd have it better. You don't think that because you think everybody lives that way. You see your family so rotten and mean to you, but then in front of others, in front of strangers, they act like saints. You meet other people that act like saints, and you think, well, yeah, in front of me, they're acting like that. But when their doors are closed, what are they doing to their kids? You don't know.
Are your parents still alive?
Oh, no. My mother died at 57, and God allowed, Billy Graham crusade to come to New York City when Mom was on her deathbed. I was the only one of her children left home to take care of her, and she was dying of cancer. And God sent a volunteer from the Billy Graham Crusade, which was 15 miles away from where we were living, to invite Mom to this crusade, and Mom went, even though she couldn't walk 12 feet from her bed to the bathroom. That's how sick she was. She went to that crusade. She walked from the upper tier of Madison Square Garden to the podium to give her life to Christ. It was absolutely miraculous. And her life was changed. She was a much, much different person. It was awesome. She died very shortly afterwards, but we know where she is now.
The book is called The Sicilian Nobleman's Daughter. It's written by Florence Calderon Blake. Florence, I thank you very, very much for taking the time to be on the program with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I am so honored to have been with you.
Florence Calderon Blake, author of The Sicilian Nobleman's Daughter. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0268, and you'll find the links to Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order her book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for the Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. The Stuff File presents the Idiot of the Day.
After a bank robbery in Merced, California, police got a pretty good lead on the robber who escaped with $2,748. He had a distinctive tattoo, actually several distinctive tattoos, on his face, neck, and elsewhere. Armed with the description, a police officer quickly spotted the suspect, who was stuffing wads of bills into his pants. After bringing the suspect to the police station, the officer was walking him upstairs for questioning when money started falling out of the man's pants. Eventually, all $2,748 ended up on the floor. And 25-year-old Sean Lee Canfield allegedly confessed to the crime. Okay, I've seen his mugshot, resplendent with his tattoos. He's got a huge tattoo that covers his right eye, going almost to the top of his forehead and down to the bottom of his cheek. And he's got another tattoo that rings around his neck. I mean, did he really think he was going to get away with a robbery and not wear a disguise? I mean, why would someone who looks like that think he could get away with conducting a very public bank robbery with multiple witnesses? One reason, and one reason only, he's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0268. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0268. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as PA Holder, and don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it for this week's show. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Experienced another edition of the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Now, doesn't that make you feel all warm and fuzzy? Like watching puppies and kittens frolicking in a field of daisies. Like the smells coming from Grandma's kitchen. Like the hallucinogenics you took in the 60s and I'm taking right now. Hello, cartoon birdies. Perhaps I've said too much. Anyway, you know what I mean. Let the glow wash over you and enjoy. Peace out.